This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. Let me find my glasses. There they are. I'm driving home a little bit later than I normally do. Dropped off at the church. Got some things done there for Sunday. Helped out, I should say. Helped out. Now I'm heading home. Which means that I'm a little more underpowered than usual. So hopefully what I say here will make sense. All is well. It's been a good week at work. Got a lot of things. Got a big rollout done this week. I was hoping to get finished up with a demo this week. But at the last minute, I had a couple of pieces I was recording, and I didn't share my screen to the video, so I've got to go do those two pieces over again. But it won't be too bad. I'll get that done on Monday, get everything spliced together for the video help. And then, excuse me, go from there. So that will all be fine. So that's good. The editing is going a little slower than I'd like. I wanted to be farther along than I am, but that's okay. We'll get that done. Tomorrow is Magna Carta Day. So have a couple of little things. I just got to get everything on tonight and make sure that's all fine. I've got to make myself a mask yet, but I'm just going to use a regular medical mask and put some stuff over the top of it to sort of, not really, but sort of make it look like chainmail. I've got some sort of. It won't be great, but it'll be fine. It'll be fine. I'm getting together with a friend tomorrow. We normally would get together for breakfast on the second Friday of the month. But we're still not quite open in our places where we go, so we're just going to get together for a walk tomorrow morning. So that should be fun. Be nice to see him again. I haven't gotten a chance to really talk with him for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. I think the last time we got together was maybe the second Friday in March, maybe. But maybe it was the second Friday, second Friday in February. I don't know. But it's been a long, long time. So looking forward to that. Family as well. All is well. Costumes are well. I've been putting together additional costumes for things coming up. Experimenting with a few things here and there. So that all is going fine. The hair comes off tomorrow. Ba-da-da-da! Finally. Normally it's Good Friday, but we got delayed because of COVID-19. So the hair comes off tomorrow, and I have a dentist appointment tomorrow. And for both of those, I'm going to put the donut costume back on. Because the lady who's cutting my hair, I said, well, we can either do Magna Carta Day or we can do donut. And she said, what? She said, so I showed her the donut. She got this big grin on her face and started laughing. And so I said, we'll do donut day. So that'll be fine. I came across an article and I thought, oh, this is good. And it actually kind of goes hand in hand with what we were talking about last week. And that is the idea that the best path in life is following the commandments that Christ, that Jesus said were the two most important, and that is love God, love your neighbor as yourself. Which is, those are very demanding, those are very demanding commands. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Because the word for love your neighbor there is agape, which means it is all-encompassing, self-sacrificial. I mean, it's big. That's big. So obviously I've been kind of watching the things that are going on in the news. It's just all just so interesting to see how things are developing. But in the process of that, an article came up on a website that I frequently go to see what interesting articles they have. And the website is getpocket.com. And Pocket is a little thing where you can bookmark things and then, you know, read them offline and that kind of thing. So there's, you know, a lot of interesting stuff there.
Excuse me.
They do a good job of come up with some pretty interesting things and not just what everybody else is saying. And so the title of this article was "Our Brains Tell Us Stories So We Can Live." This is by Robert A. Burton. And the subtitle is, "Without Inner Narratives, We Would Be Lost in a Chaotic World." And he starts the article by talking about the fact that we are all storytellers, that we make sense out of the world by telling stories. And he claims that science is a great source of stories. He says, now you might say, no, science is not stories. Science is an objective collection and interpretation of data. And he said, well, he does agree with that. And at one level, that's true, so long as science is studying the purely physical phenomena. He claims that science is the only reliable method for establishing facts of the world. But the problem is, and I've mentioned this kind of thing before in these podcasts, is that science, quote unquote, scientists, let's say, tend to not stick in the purely objective. They tend to take those facts and then reach conclusions, which is nothing more than hypotheses are. That's a conclusion, a story, if you will. And then, once that story gets embedded, sometimes it gets very, very difficult to back away from it. And in fact, in this article, he may provide some explanation of why it seems like scientists do, once there is some evidence and they get started in a different direction, a lot of time it's really hard for them to back out. And they begin tuning their observations to the story as opposed to tuning the hypothesis to the evidence. I mean, there's lots of examples of this where people just will dig in their heels and say, no, science has already proven this, when it's simply just a hypothesis. So he says that this happens when we use the data. He says this happens when we extend incomplete data to draw general conclusions. At that point, then, we are telling stories. He says, knowing the atomic weight of carbon and oxygen cannot tell us what life is. There are no naked facts themselves that completely explain why animals sacrifice for the good of their kin, why we fall in love, the meaning of existence, or why we kill each other. All right? He says, science is not at fault. He said, on the contrary, science can save us from false stories. It is an irreplaceable means of understanding our world. But despite the verities of science, many of our most important questions compel us to tell stories that venture beyond the facts. For all the sophisticated methodologies in science, we have not moved beyond the story as the primary way we make sense of our lives. And that's absolutely true. I think that's absolutely true. Now, what's interesting is that he goes on to talk about the fact, and he has some other things in here about how we crave patterns and all that kind of stuff, but I think one of the things in here that's really important that he brings up is that when we embrace these stories and we find something to support that story, no matter how ugly the story may be, no matter how unlikely the story, no matter how disturbing the story, if we have decided on a story and then we find something to back that up, our brains are actually set up to where we get a little pop, a little dopamine pop, a little sense of familiarity or a powerful, see, you know. And that little pop is actually meted out by the same reward system in the brain that is integral to drugs and alcohol and gambling addictions. So the rewards system extends from the limbic area of the brain, vital to the expression of emotion, to the prefrontal cortex, critical to executive thought. He said, though we still understand this imperfectly, it is generally thought that the reward system plays a central role in promotion and reinforcement to learning, and that key to this system and found primarily within its brain cells is dopamine, a neurotransmitter that carries and modulates signals among brain cells. Studies consistently show that feeling rewarded is accompanied by rises in dopamine levels. Now, this is really important. I'm getting my mail once a moment. One moment. So that's really interesting. So that then helps partially, I think, explain where sometimes people reach conclusions about the nature of life that you wouldn't think is a conclusion that people would want to reach or stick with, and yet they stick with it. And I think this partially may be an explanation for that, that once you find some explanation that makes sense to you, then every time you find something to strengthen that, you feel rewarded. You feel like, aha, see, I was right. He goes on the article to say, critical to understanding how stories spark the brain's reward system is the theory known as pattern recognition, the brain's way of piecing together a number of separate components of an image into a coherent picture. The first time you see a lion, for instance, you have to figure out what you're seeing. At least 30 separate areas of the brain's visual cortex pitch in, each processing an aspect of the overall image, from the detection of motion and edges to the register of color and facial features. Collectively, they form an overall image of a lion. Each subsequent exposure to a lion enhances your neural circuitry. The connections among the processing regions becomes more robust and efficient. This theory, based on the research of Canadian psychologist Donald O'Hebb, a pioneer in studying how people learn, is often stated as cells that fire together wire together. Soon, less input is necessary to recognize the lion. A fleeting glimpse of a partial picture is sufficient for recognition, which occurs via positive feedback from your reward system. Yes, you are assured by your brain that is a lion. Okay, so he goes on to say, people and science are like bread and butter. We are hardwired to need stories. Science has storytelling buried deep within its nature, but there is also a problem. We can get our dopamine reward and walk away with a story in hand before science has finished testing it. The problem is exacerbated by the fact that the brain, hungry for its pattern-matching dopamine rewards, overlooks contradictory or conflicting information wherever possible. A fundamental prerequisite for pattern recognition is the ability to quickly distinguish between similar but not identical inputs. Not being able to pigeonhole an event or an idea makes it much more difficult for the brain to label and store it as a discrete memory. Neat and tidy promotes learning. Loose ends lead to yes, but of indecision, lead to the, quote, yes, but, close quote, of indecision and inability to draw a precise conclusion. Okay, so he goes on. It has, you know, all kinds of other things. He gives examples in here of how mass murderers. There's the idea that, oh, maybe they have this problem and they're therefore that might be indicative of violent people, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and so we're running to conclusions before we actually have meticulously obtained and analyzed data. And for me, I doubt that the author of the article would agree with me probably on this. For me, what this shows is that we have to be very careful about the stories that we tell ourselves, because it's easy for us to latch on to stories. And we have to be wise about what those stories look like and what is the nature of those stories. Because I think, at least in my framework, in the flesh and spirit framework, it's not hard to figure out what story we're latching onto it and whether or not we should be latching onto that story. I talked last week about the fact that a lot of these theories going around, a lot of these claims, that if we see that they are pushing us towards us versus them, if the language is us versus them, that's destructive. Because Jesus told us that the way to life, the things that we should pursue in terms of commands is love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. So love your neighbor as yourself doesn't seek to categorize us versus them. That's really a flesh response. And wherever you start out with us versus them, you can count on the fact that the flesh is going to keep pushing that, and you're just going to slide right down a slope into something that's bad. And it's not hard to see that happening with what's been happening with the George Floyd demonstrations and the latest today. Who knows where we'll be in a week or 2 weeks. The latest today is that we've had an area in Seattle that's been taken over by the anarchists, and they're patrolling and they're saying this is a police-free zone. And the mayor at this point right now has told the police not to interfere, and et cetera, et cetera. And we just see this slide because if there is a push in a story that establishes us versus them, and that push is coming from the flesh, which I interpret it because us versus them is not love your neighbor as yourself, you can expect that that is going to be destructive and that it'll just keep pushing towards more and more destruction. So I was thinking about stories this week, and I was just sort of reminiscing and reading more things, because there's been plenty of stories that have been told this week. And it's so fascinating to watch these stories and see how people kind of come down on the side of whatever is the current in vogue of things to do. So I was listening to a man, and I don't know sports, so I don't know, you know, I don't know who the guy was. Apparently, he was biracial, so one of mother, dad, something, you know, white, black, fine. And that put him in a really awkward position growing up, because he would go to the white school and, of course, they would all disparage him because he was half black. And then he would go to the African-American community and they would disparage him because he wasn't black enough. And so he was caught between. But despite all that, he was able to rise and make a success of it. And, you know, he's in a major sporting event now, and he has, from all outward appearances, succeeded. But he has a story that he tells himself. And the story that he tells himself is about white privilege. And the story that he repeated for this interview, which is the reason he got the article, because he had, you know, a way, a way to explain white privilege. His story was, well, white privilege, a lot of white people, they don't even realize they have white privilege because it's like this invisible backpack that they carry around. And anytime they need to, they just whip it out and they just pull out all kinds of stuff that helps them. So that's the story that he's telling himself. It's us and them. They are unfairly advantaged because they're white. But as I mentioned last week, I hear things like that, and I understand in my interpretation where that's coming from, because we all have this tendency from the push of the flesh to quantify us into us versus them. We all have that. It's very easy to let ourselves cascade into that because the flesh is constantly going to be pushing that, pushing us versus them. And it's interesting to me when I hear someone talk about the invisible backpack that white people carry around, because I have two reactions to that. One is that there were a whole bunch of white guys that would have loved to be in the position that he is in terms of playing sports with some major franchise, and they didn't make it. And in fact, there's a whole bunch of white guys who don't make it in major sports like basketball because it's predominantly African Americans, which is fine, skill-based, that's fine. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is I look at the talk of white privilege as this invisible backpack. And the first thought that comes to my mind, as I mentioned last week, was, yeah, but you've got an invisible American backpack that you're not even aware of. And the only way you become aware of it is when you head overseas and see how people in poor nations live. Because there's very few families in America where the children are constantly playing in front of open sewers, where parents have to worry that their child is going to get dysentery and die. There's very few places in America, if any, where young girls are forced into marriages too early and are forced into pregnancies too early, such that when they have their babies, things tear and rip because they're just not ready, and they end up with fistulas that are dumping. I'm sorry, this is really graphic, so I'm going to pause for 5 seconds and just run forward about 15, 20 seconds or so, because this is graphic. Things tear, and in the process of tearing, they end up with excrement dumping into their vaginas. There are conditions around the world that are horrific conditions that people are living in, that we as Americans cannot conceptualize of. Guarantee you that if people went over to Bangladesh or India, that there would be places in Bangladesh and India and even in the Philippines where individuals are living at the garbage dumps because they're just waiting for the truck to come in so they can pick through the garbage and maybe find something that they can eat or something that they can sell, because the poverty is crushing. But, sorry, I haven't eaten since Tuesday night, so I'm making a lot of noise here. So when you start telling yourself a story about an invisible backpack that white people have, and you do the us versus them, it's very easy for that to cloud your perception and only see that, and not realize that there are other similar stories that could be told about you. And maybe it's not so much us versus them, but that we all struggle with this kind of falsehoods that we tell ourselves. And I don't think it's very hard for us to differentiate what kind of story we're telling ourselves, whether it's a valuable story to tell us ourselves or whether it's something that will lead us to destruction. Because if the stories that we tell ourselves churn us up, if they put unrest into our spirits and animosity and hatred and envy and jealousy, if they spawn the things that Paul identifies as the works of the flesh, that ain't spirit, that's flesh. And you can be guaranteed that that is going to have a destructive influence on your life, whether or not you say it out loud. Because your inner life that you have, the stories that you mull over, it doesn't really matter as much what you try to project and the mask that you try to put on. If those stories are running behind the scenes constantly, it will just eat you up inside. And it will create enough noise that it will actually block you from the richness of life. And it will deny you opportunities. And that's really the danger that I see in people telling themselves stories that are destructive. I've worked with enough people in my life that I've seen lots and lots of examples of how people approach life. And I have known people who are in what should have been a privileged existence. I mean, a white guy in tech, that's a privileged position. There's no question about that. A white guy in tech. And I was talking, and I've mentioned this before, but I was talking to a buddy of mine, and I mentioned a white guy in tech. I said, man, if you're a white guy in tech, they could drop you in the middle of New York City naked and you'd be fine. You know, you would find somebody. And my buddy said, well, I wasn't naked, he said, but I basically had nothing. He said, and it was New York. And he said, I had accidentally checked my bag with all my ID in it and with all my tickets and with all my, and he talked his way onto the train. He went and talked to the teller, and the teller said, oh, there's nothing I could do for you there. And then he went and talked to the manager and explained everything to the manager. And the manager said, well, look, you know, I'm not supposed to do this, but, you know, here's the ticket. And he said, he's over there sitting and waiting. And the teller that he saw came on break, and she came over and she said, well, were you able to get that worked out? Because, you know, I can buy a ticket for you if you want. And I mean, you know, that's when you're a white guy in tech, you kind of get that. Okay. And you look at that and you say, okay, there's privilege there. And there is privilege. There is that. But some of it has to do with how you're relating to people as well. And so it's not to say that there are inequities in how people are dealt with. There are inequities, but those inequities don't write the story of your life. The story of your life is written by the story that you adopt. And if you're constantly meditating on how unfair this is and how that person has got more than you do, there's this noise that will generate up in your system that it will block you from being able to move forward and succeed in life. Many years ago, after I'd written the music notation system and it had become a success and I made some money off of that, and then I was out of it for a while, and then a friend called me that I'd worked with and said, hey, it was something like, it's my 20th anniversary at this company. Do you want to come up and say hello? And it was like the 25th anniversary of this package. I think it was 25th that I had written. And I said, sure. So I flew myself up there. And while I was up there, the chief financial officer had organized a thing where he said, hey, can you get together and just tell us the old stories of getting started? Sure, I can do that. And so I was telling them about how I'd gotten started. And I related the story about how I was looking for a music notation system and there was just nothing out there. And I called a company. And I said, if I play on your keyboard, will it write out the music for me? And they said, no, we're working on that. And then for some reason, the lady said, and if you write a program, we'll pay you royalties. I wasn't a programmer. I was a musician. And I kind of chuckled. I said, okay, well, thanks much. Because my first reaction, my first story that I told myself was, well, that's not something I can do. And then I hung up the phone in my little four-room tar paper shack home that I had bought for $14,500 on an owner finance. And I took a step back from the phone and I felt the surge within me. And suddenly there was this thought, and I thought, you know, this cannot be that hard. And when I related that story to all these programmers, all these white guys in tech who were in this room up in Minneapolis, and when I said, you know, this cannot be that hard, the room erupted in laughter. Because they could not believe that a musician without any programming skill, knowing the complexities of music notation, would have that reaction. So the question then becomes is, why did I have that reaction? What story was I telling myself that would lead me to that reaction? And the answer is the greatest privilege that I have ever enjoyed in my life, and that is to have two parents who loved me, who loved God, who were plugged in, had a daily supernatural experience with God, and believed that God was an ever-present help in times of trouble, and who instilled in me the story that whatever you put your hand to do, you can succeed because God will help you. And so even though I had that initial reaction from the flesh of, well, you can't write a program because you're not a programmer and you don't know anything about computers and you were overseas and you never had the chance to learn about computers. All you did was go to IBM and see what a card looked like. That was in the days of the old computer cards. That's all you, and you can't, and you can't, and you can't. And when I stepped back and God whispered, that story surged, and I thought, you know, I can, and this cannot be that hard. And there were plenty of times when I was working on that music notation system on the old Apple II computer, there were plenty of times when I was just at a loss. I had no idea what to do next. But the story that was running in me was this, not that this was a fool's errand and I was an idiot because I wasn't as good as programmers any kind. The story that was running is God is helping me, God is working with me. And so I would go and I would kneel down and I'd pray, oh God, you got me into this. I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know where the problem is. I mean, there's a long story about the fact that I had to build my own tools for debugging because I didn't think I could. It's huge. And every time as I'd go and I'd kneel down and I'd pray, then an answer would pop into my head and it would be like, oh, that's where the problem is. And so then I'd go and fix it. And it was one thing after another, after another, after another. And eventually we built this thing. And then, of course, it was, well, this will succeed. Let's talk to some people. Let's get them in here. Let's show them this and let's move on to the next thing. And all along the way, it was, well, yeah, this will succeed. Because God will help us. I mean, we didn't take any foolish financial risk. We didn't invest everything in the farm. We didn't do anything like that. We just built it one section at a time, being prudent, being wise, moving through, expecting God's help, because those were the stories I was raised with. Now, if I had been raised instead with stories of, well, you'll never succeed because you don't know what you're doing, And there are so many other people out there that are so much better than you. And besides, even if you did get something else, you know, no one's going to actually look at you because you're X or Y or Z. And, you know, you're never going to be able to get ahead because you've got these people who are oppressing you and keeping you down. Whether that's true or not, the story internally is destructive. And the story internally separates us versus them. And it's been fascinating to listen to the stories here recently that have been floating around. And you kind of look at that and go, what? I mean, obviously the big story that's floating around, the premise is that George Floyd was killed because of systemic racism on the police force. And depending on how you pick your facts, it's easy to come up with that story. It's easy. Because there have been 15, I think in 2019 it was 15 African-Americans killed by police in 2019. But then, you hear about an incident in 2016 where there was a white guy who was drunk who called the police because he was afraid he was going to do something bad to someone. So he calls the police to come and help him. And one thing leads to another, and he ends up face down on the street with a knee in his back for 13 minutes, and he ends up dying. There was no outrage. There was no story there. So maybe it's not that the cop necessarily who killed George Floyd was racist. Maybe he was just a creep. Maybe he's just a murderer. I mean, there's more stories coming out now that maybe they knew each other because they worked at the same bar. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that the story can be crafted without immediately racing to a story that divides everything into us versus them. Us versus them. The other one that I've been bemused at this week is the story with J.K. Rowling, where J.K. Rowling, I think very appropriately, comes out and says, look, you can love anybody you want to love, you can dress anybody that you want to dress, but there is differences in biology, and I have spent my life in the biology of being a woman, and I don't want to see that erased. And I think there's a distinctive in biology for being a woman. Okay. And the amazing thing that has come out of this is, in fact, that men who are tagged with mansplaining, you know, that, oh, you're just mansplaining stuff. Women who have been tagged by women of mansplaining, not really understanding, you know, treating women like they don't understand, you know, telling women basically you're wrong, this is the way you should think about it, that the male actors who are part of the Harry Potter series have been tagged as coming out and saying, oh no, transgender women are women. Okay, in other words, we are going to have men now mansplain to women what it means to be a woman. Apparently that's okay, because our story is that because we have a bunch of guys who've decided that they're women, that if we don't let them call themselves women, if we don't let them claim that they're just like biological females, if we don't let them erase the experience of biological females, that there must be something wrong with us. Again, you get into us versus them again. And the other one that I got tickled with just the other day, and not to get too political, because Lord knows we have enough of that. So Vice President Joe Biden has come out and said either yesterday or today that You know, absolutely, he thinks the military will intervene if Trump loses the election. And because, you know, Trump probably won't move out of the White House if he loses the election, and he's going to try to steal the election. So there's all these fabrications of these stories that he's predicting the future, and he's predicting it in the way that reflects as poorly as possible on Trump, condemning Trump for an act that hasn't even happened yet. And that's the story. Us versus them. Now, look, I'm not going to defend Trump with all the tweeting and all that this junk. Okay. Oh, man. What an interesting 4 years it's been. But to just make this story up whole hog out of nothing and then get people to sign on and just blasted across the media. It's really fascinating. How do we know that that story is destructive and not just preventative? Well, first of all, it's accusatory. It's not really based on any facts. It's condemning. And it very much draws a line between us versus them, because if you don't agree with that, well, then obviously you're just one of those Trump supporters and rah, 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 you know. So it's all really, really interesting. But my concern is that, I've got to wrap this up. My concern is that if people adopt stories that are destructive, that are isolating, that are debilitating, even though they may be getting dopamine pops every time they find something that supports that story, and even though their flesh might be going, yeah, yeah, that's right, yeah, that they, them, they're the enemy, yeah, yeah, that's why you can't get ahead in life, oh, yeah, yeah. Even though they will get some pleasure kickback from that, ultimately, that story will eat them alive. And it will create so much noise that they will miss so many activities, so many opportunities that could better their lives, that I would just encourage us all to be very careful of the stories that we adopt. That we should embrace stories that are filled with kindness, that are filled with mercy, filled with grace, filled with an understanding that our God is an ever-present help, and that no matter what we're facing, that He can create around us an environment of success and an environment of success for all the people who are around us. And no matter what we're facing, we can live a life of peace and of generosity and of kindness and of love. Because this is just the beginning. And that's, I think, one of the most important stories that we can tell ourselves. Jesus came to this earth and He suffered and He died and He has called us to be His own. And we may end up suffering with Him. And every day we're not suffering, that's a good day. And every day we are suffering, if we are suffering with Him, that's a good day as well. And the only true sad days are the days in which we are letting our flesh tell us stories that are destructive, that are debilitating, that are disempowering, when we can turn our attention towards God and be grateful and ask for His help so that we can be the best we can be every day. This is Phil Ferrand, and I am long, but I have finally made it home.